Welcome to Grumpy Strategists episode 57. Actually, it's the first episode of the new incarnation. It's the Trumpy Strategists.
And we're coming to you, our listeners, from the Donald J. Trump Strategic Analysis Australia bunker deep within the Brindabellas. We're getting ahead of the curve. We've named ourselves after Donald J. Trump. It is the thing to do. We now have the Donald J. Trump Ballroom. We have the Donald J. Trump Institute of Peace. I'm not sure why we need an Institute of Peace since he's ended all of the conflicts in the war in the world. But anyway,
well, he is the president of peace, and you need an institute. He is.
And of course, the Donald J. Trump and John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts. So we're just getting ahead of the curve here.
I like that one. Donald J. Trump and John F. Kennedy Arts Center, but I think it's a bit long. I think we've got to get rid of that Kennedy.
The Kennedy bit.
Yeah, but it's a good start. I mean, it is a good start.
I mean, what's JFK done for you recently?
That's right. I mean, he's dead.
He's nothing. So
Well, actually, one of his relatives is doing great stuff by stopping kiddies getting vaccinated. He's done a lot for measles.
Yeah, I mean, the world is a strange place, Michael.
Well, the bunker is getting stranger. I mean, your idea to make it, what did you say? Let's gold, bring a bit of Mar-a-Lago into the bunker.
A bit of bling?
I've got gold nice. Paint all over me because I got in here before all that gilt had dried. I don't know how to get the stuff
it's
off.
It's looking pretty nice. You know, and when we'll get the excavators in, the tunnel borers in for our own ballroom, and it will be very gold, very blingy.
Well, look, we just got to move faster than the National Capital Authority can stop us, I reckon, here in Canberra.
But, yes, Washington, very strange, very strange. Susie Wiles, big interview in Vanity Fair. I mean, if anything was ever a cry for help, a plea from somebody with Stockholm Syndrome, you see Susie there, her hands and face up against
the glass. Pressed against
the glass. Pressed against the glass, saying, you don't know what it's like in here.
I reckon she was trying to escape through the East Wing and the wrecking ball drove her back inside the building. That's, I think, what happened. She spent a year talking to that journo. And now we're hearing, oh, he took stuff out of context.
Yeah.
Well, what she actually said, whatever the context wrapped around it, Trump has an alcoholic personality, which is apparently high praise. And the just damning stuff about people from J.D. Vance to Rubio to Robert
all of them.
Kennedy. No, just
Elon.
Is he or is he not taking ketamine? Who cares? He's sleeping in a sleeping bag in the executive office building. It just was a picture of the inner craziness of second-term Trump.
It's massive craziness, yeah. And for her to somehow think, I'm speaking on the record with a journo and they're not going to publish this? It's like, no, I don't believe that. I mean, it could be, yes, a form of saying, I want to bear witness to the craziness that's going on, but I don't want to walk away from the craziness.
Well, and also,
you're part of it.
Well, maybe it's a bit of, remember, the thing about the first Trump administration was all the adults in the room. I think she's quietly making the point, I'm an adult in the room and I'm surrounded by crazy people. So don't blame me for everything. That's what I think is behind
well,
some of it.
Well, you will bear the taint, I'm afraid. You will bear the taint. The other sort of craziness out of Washington is, well, the death, apparently murder, seems to be, of the director Rob Reiner
and his wife
mm-hmm. apparently by their son.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Reiner, I mean, what movie did he make, Michael?
Princess Bride.
The Princess
not
Bride.
Just The Princess Bride. How about When Harry Met Sally?
My favourite movie of all time, maybe second favourite movie, Spinal Tap. It goes up to 11. All of these movies that the poor guy's been murdered and in the obituaries people, there's lists of all the movies that he did and you're going, he did that? He did that? I mean, he did so many movies, but I mean, so many of the sort of the quotable quotes in our everyday vernacular, certainly in the Grumpy Strategists, you know, are from Rob Reiner movies.
Well, exactly. Like Princess Bride, I think we were talking about Trump's defense of his economic record and how he's saying affordability is some Democrat hoax word.
Well, it is that quote, I do not think this word means what you think it means. We used to say that in reference to Albanese government ministers talking about the acceleration of defence projects. I don't think acceleration means what you think it means, but yeah, I'm not sure affordability means what Trump seems to think it means.
Average Americans seem to think affordability means
you can afford
the price
stuff?
Of their stuff getting higher and can they not afford it? That's what I think they mean.
Something's affordable if I can have enough money to buy it.
Mm. If I can't buy stuff I used to be able to buy, things have become less affordable, is I think what the average American means. But that is not the meaning that Donald Trump takes of the word. Donald Trump, I think, takes of the word, are a whole lot of Americans better off since I took office? And the answer to that is yes.
Well, there's a small group of Americans whose last name is Trump are massively better off.
Well, and a lot of wealthy people around Mr. Trump are also much better off. There's been some great work out of US media on that recently.
I don't think affordability was ever an issue for them. I mean, there's only so many super yachts that you can actually own. So,
yeah, but if you're the kind of person that buys a super yacht, the thing that hurts the most is when your counterpart billionaire turns up with a bigger, more gold super yacht beside you. So that affordability crunch can hurt them too. Mm.
And then, of course, in response to the rather tragic death of Rob Reiner, we have maybe one of the sort of low points. It's hard to imagine, you know, all of the low points that how you could actually get much lower with Donald Trump. But, you know, one of the true low points was his Truth Social message, where he basically said the death of Rob Reiner was caused by his Trump derangement syndrome.
Yes. Yes, not by being stabbed to death allegedly by his troubled son. Yes.
An absolute low point there, which interestingly seems to have been unacceptable to a lot of Republicans who, for whatever reason, have accepted every other shameful thing that Trump has done. That, for whatever reason, they feel they needed to respond to.
Well, there's a couple of things going on in the MAGA movement that are kind of cracks in the MAGA movement. I think the reaction to Trump's just shameful thoughts about the death of Rob Reiner, who certainly was one of the most creative human beings on the planet, and to be so vindictive about him, that's caused a split inside different parts of the MAGA and Republican movement, but also even some of the stuff that's been on display at Erica Kirk's first outing with Turning Point USA, Charlie Kirk's old movement. There's been disagreement from the stage instead of celebration because a few of the people have had the gall to criticise Tucker Carlson, the extremely influential MAGA type, and him hosting a pro-Hitler guy, Nick Fuentes. And they're actually having arguments about, is it right to support those voices?
Well, this is the dynamic of authoritarian movements is they become more and more extreme to maintain the momentum. And so we're seeing that occurring in the MAGA movement of more and more extreme voices. But because of this sort of philosophy of no enemy to my right, so, you know, we can all unite to own the Dems, to own the Libs, so we can't criticize each other, means you have extreme right-wing people saying absolutely appalling, overt, explicit anti-Semitic things,
the kind of
and they're
things
not getting criticised.
Could drive violence in your community. And J.D. Vance, I think, is the epitome of that kind of there's no enemy to my right voice.
You know, they're just joking around. It's just boys being boys.
Well, he said something at the Turning Point conference along the lines of, Donald Trump didn't build the massive coalition that he did that brought him to power by cancelling people. You know, we don't cancel voices in our movement. We welcome them all in, except, of course, for the wrong voices, who are the voices of the Democrats or any critic of DJ Trump.
Yeah. So explicitly anti-Semitic, explicitly pro-Hitler, that's okay.
Well, that's what Nick Fuentes was. And yes, J.D. Vance was defending that voice.
Yes, well, this is the administration running the country that is Australia's primary ally. Well, we'll talk about this a bit later on. But we've raised the issue of anti-Semitism, which of course leads us to the very tragic, very sad events at Bondi just over a week ago, and the murder. It is the murder. There's no other way you can describe it. Mass murder of 15 people. Absolutely shocking. I think many of us sort of may have thought that something like this would have been possible. It's occurred in other Western democracies, and it's happened.
Yes, well, it being possible is very different from when it actually happens.
Yes.
I think there's an enormous amount of shock around the country. But I suppose, to me, one of the good things since that horrific mass murder has been the way so much of the Australian community has come together calling for unity and doing the opposite of stoking division. And we've seen it from Islamic leaders, other religious leaders, Bondi surf lifesavers, ordinary citizens doing a paddle out at Bondi, and a whole bunch of people around the country probably having that moment of commemoration and remembrance yesterday. So at a community level, I think there's been some real hope out of this that is maybe tamping down some of the division. I don't think it's been that impressive at the political level.
Now, I think, you know, it's completely understandable that the Australian Jewish community feels, you know, abandoned, feels that they've been isolated, singled out, that they haven't been protected by their governments, both state and federal. I think that's entirely legitimate. So that can be true. That perception, that feeling can be completely true. I mean, my partner is Jewish, and even before this, she was saying that, you know, she felt in a way she'd never felt before in Australia, of vulnerable.
Which is a remarkable phenomenon,
And that can be true. It can also be true that the broader Australian community is actually responding to this and coming together and sort of, you know, very explicitly saying this is completely unacceptable and what can we do to make this not happen again. So, you know, to say that's a positive, I'm not sure anything is positive in the wake of such a horrible event. But, you know, I don't sort of, again, people have very visceral immediate responses. So where we have people saying, well, this shows that multiculturalism has failed or multiculturalism is dead. You know, we have these responses with people saying Albo has blood on his hands. Again, I can see you may feel that if you're part of the Australian Jewish community. I don't think that's a legitimate kind of response from a politician or a professional commentator.
Well,
can point to a lot of the things the Albanese government had done. Whether it worked, whether it was enough, that's a separate issue from not doing anything and not trying. So, but I do think, I've just lost my train of thought. Can we edit that up?
My thought is it's just not right to say that the Prime Minister has blood on his hands. I think this has been, the Labor government is generally an inactive government that is determined to have policy drift. I think there were lots of words about their commitment to anti-Semitism. I don't think that the argument that them recognising the state of Palestine drove this murderous set of events in any way makes any sense at all.
I think
some of the criticism is misplaced, but generally I think the government has engaged in masterful drift across most of the policy waterfront.
Well, all I'd say is people have been very quick to assign blame or causality here. I have no idea how the two criminals, terrorist criminals, that's the only way you can describe them, how they were radicalised and got to the point where they thought it was legitimate for some reason to go and kill 15 people or however many people they were hoping to kill, and they were deliberately, you know, it seems pretty unambiguous, they were deliberately targeting Jews.
Yeah, a Jewish celebration, so they were obviously targeting Australian
And they
seem
to be
people.
Ignoring people who were they thought were not Jews.
Yes.
So, but that whole radicalization process, I don't know how that occurred. So it's very hard to assign blame there or causality there. So, you know, all I'd say is if you do want to, as quickly as possible, work out if these people were part of a broader cell, whether there is a broader conspiracy here, whether other attacks are being planned. Yep. Yeah, the security services.
Did they just do it themselves, or are they part of a bigger cell? Or
so that needs to be done quickly and thoroughly.
Yep.
But this sort of rush to assign blame and to condemn, I think, well, let's investigate this properly. Is that a Royal Commission? You know, some I'm a bit agnostic on whether it's a Royal Commission or some other kind of review. Royal Commissions have great powers. They tend to be quite slow, though. So yeah, if you want sort of rapid action, Royal Commissions are probably not the way to go.
Well, to me, you could do some rapid things, which might be a whole lot of words. It might be moves to tighten some of the gun laws. I mean, who thinks it is sensible to have high-powered weapons and rapid-fire shotguns in lots of suburban homes in our major cities? I don't think that makes any sense. And I think a lot of Australians would say, do they really want those kind of weapons locked up in family homes in their neighbourhoods? I'd say no. So you could do some things quickly. But I'm with you on, well, actually, we've got a bunch of laws. We've got a bunch of counterterrorism machinery. Rushing to things like stopping public gatherings because you think they might be dangerous and making a whole bunch of new laws, they have a whole lot of other consequences for our freedoms and way of life. And I think we've got to be a little more thoughtful about that. On an inquiry, I think the problem with any internal inquiry or led by someone like an eminent ex-bureaucrat who's the go-to reviewer for the government, which is
the government has just
Dennis
announced.
Richardson is, I think the problem is public confidence, because there will probably be no public inquiry. We wouldn't even know if the report would be published, because the last review by this eminent person was into the submarine agency.
Well, and we haven't seen it. We don't even know if there was a written report.
We don't even know if a document exists. So for public trust, an arm's length, powerful, objective, external inquiry is what we need.
Yes, and for with certain parts of the Australian community, the Albanese government's credibility and trust is very low at the moment.
When you've got the Prime Minister being booed at a memorial event, probably having an in-house inquiry that's wholly in the control of the government is a bad idea. So I am a fan of a Royal Commission, because I think it would be properly objective, arm's length, powerful and forensic, and it should take the time it needs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just on the issue of multiculturalism, you know, has it I don't think Australian multiculturalism has failed at all. Now, we can have a legitimate discussion about immigration and levels of immigration and the categories of immigration, and we can do that in a responsible way, and you can do it without calling other people, you know, racist or whatever.
Yep.
But that's a very separate issue from saying whether Australian multiculturalism has failed. I mean, in the last week, I had, hashtag proud dad moment where I went to my daughter's law school graduation down in Melbourne. And it's interesting. I mean, I don't know if you've, ever sat in sort of event like this and sort of idly one gone, gosh, if somebody stood up and started firing now, where would I go? What would I do? And I've had those thoughts before, but I certainly had them at this event. Ooh. So there was that going through my head, because this was literally,
right in the aftermath,
three or four days after the Bondi massacre. But also, I'm sitting there and watching a stream of bright young Australians walking across the stage, and it was truly a multicultural event. Yes, there were a lot of people who had what seemed to be they had Muslim names, but they were with African names. There was, Anglo names. There was, it truly was a multicultural event, as were the proud parents and families sitting there.
Yeah, I think that's an example of success of multicultural Australia myself. And I would say pictures just of Bondi Beach show that same success of diversity. Mm-hmm. So my view is this is part of this rush about everything. Like we must must make changes right now about everything, and we must make these grand statements about what is right and what is wrong. And ascribe blame
before we fully understand how this happened.
All we're going to do is score a series of own goals if we do that. So my thoughts are with everybody that was affected by the Bondi shootings, the people, the Jewish community that suffered those horrible deaths and murders, and also everybody affected in other ways. A lot of there's a lot of shock in the community. So, but I think a proper public open inquiry that makes thoughtful suggestions for change rather than some rushed political fix-it is probably what we need.
And I would agree, and I just would echo that point that the Australian Jewish community is relatively small, and of course, you know, it. I think this attack focused on a part of it, so the eastern suburbs community, I think, was very heavily represented there. It's a small community. When you have an event of this magnitude on a small community,
everybody in that community will be affected.
Everyone, everybody will know somebody who
around that community.
Everybody will know somebody who was killed or wounded. Yeah. You know, so there is a lot of fear, and so there will be a lot of responses which will be true to them. And we have to acknowledge that.
Now, thinking about the year in review, like I don't think the Trumpy strategists can let the year go by without a quick look back at the military capability, decisions, and momentum in Australia.
Yeah, we haven't talked about, you know, one of my favourite topics, which is defence capability, and there's a few things going on there that we should probably talk about.
Take me through it. I'm sure.
All right. Well, recently, so Ghostbat, the autonomous aerial vehicle
Boeing Australia,
designed by Boeing Australia. I believe a lot of the operating software is by BAE. So there's a number of companies involved, both the at the prime level, but also smaller Australian companies. You might recall that a year or so ago, the government sort of mentioned that, you know, it wasn't going to be armed. And I think you were quite annoyed at this. Like, why go to all of the effort?
Why are we doing this?
You know, if you're not going to arm this system. Well, it has test-fired an air-to-air missile, you know, and I think it's, if not the first, it's one of the first UAVs that's actually fired an air-to-air missile.
Well, I hope that's only going to be used for defensive purposes. I wouldn't want this to be an offensive armed capability.
Well, that is sort of one of the weird things about, you know, the governments, both this government and the previous government, sort of had a lot of trouble sort of publicly saying we were buying killer drones.
Armed killer drones. They could go crazy.
You and I were both still in the department, I think, when the initial announcement of getting Reaper.
Yes.
Was announced.
Since cancelled.
You know, and the government sort of had a lot of the day, couldn't really bring itself to say that it was getting a killer drone. And so we were spending a lot of time saying, how do we, you know, socialise this with the Australian public?
Well, you know, the Air Force was even funnier because they didn't want to accept the uncrewed or unmanned aerial vehicle label. They wanted it called an RPAS, R-P-A-S, Remotely Piloted Aerial System. So their way of dealing with autonomous killer drones was to deny that they could ever be anything other than remotely piloted. So Ghostbat is actually autonomous. It does fly itself.
But it was like when the service fleet review was announced, and it said recommended we should get these large optionally crewed vessels.
Yep.
But Richard Miles came out.
I think it was Dickie Miles.
Dick Miles, because he was Defence Minister.
Yep.
Came out and said, but of course we'll crew them.
Yes. Yeah, be assured.
Because again, we don't want to have killer drones out there. we now have a killer drone.
It's good progress, but it's a lot of money and there aren't many airframes, are there?
Right. So the approval seems to have been for $1.4 billion. And what we get for that is six operational Block 2 aircraft.
Six.
And development of the Block 3 prototype. So, yes, progress is happening. It's probably a good thing, but it's certainly not the small, the smart, the many.
Well, you're not happy any day that you lose one of those six, are you?
No. So, hopefully, 1.4 divided by six is roughly 200 and a bit million a pop. Hopefully, we will drive the price down below $200 million pop.
So, this is a little bit, it's the small and the smart. But it's not the Many.
We're not at the Many.
It's the smallest mart and a very expensive.
Hopefully that is what is still to come.
Yeah.
Other recent announcements. So Austal has received a roughly $1 billion contract from the government to build 18 landing craft medium.
These aren't the big ones, are they?
These are the medium ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Which, again, is a good thing, though I think we're now at about 2 years since the government first announced the sort of shotgun wedding between Austal as the builder and Burden, an Australian company, Burden as Marine. The designer.
Yeah.
Like many shotgun weddings, it didn't have a happy outcome. There's been a less than amicable divorce. Burden's been booted out. Austal has taken over the design. But at least we're now in contract.
Who got the dog? Do we know who got the dog?
Do not know who got the dog and the family home.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Well, but there's another forced marriage. That's also underway, also involving Austal. It'll be the Austal Mitsubishi Heavy Industries forced marriage over the Megami-class frigates.
Yes, well, hopefully that forced marriage goes better. But, I mean, the other thing that still isn't really resolved, so even though apparently we're about to start building the landing-class medium, and my sources do tell me that progress is being made on the landing craft heavy, so the really big landing craft, so roughly 4,000-ton vessels.
The supersized me version.
Yes, not in contract yet, but heading in the right direction. But work is going to start on both of those classes of vessels before we sort of have the Henderson master plan, before we know what goodness looks like in Henderson, which somehow has to build landing craft, build frigates, maintain
those
vessels, maintain American submarines and ultimately maintain Australian nuclear submarines. We haven't got the master plan yet.
So all that building by Austal has to happen while everything around them gets knocked down and rebuilt.
I think so.
Yeah. My other point about the forced marriage is this is not a monogamous marriage that's being forced between Austal and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. It's actually polygamy. It's a forced polygamy now because Treasurer Chalmers has agreed to Hanwha Ocean raising its stake in Austal to just under 20%. So there's a new partner in town. So there'll be a lot of love there between the South Korean and Japanese firms with the Australian strategic shipbuilder.
Well,
I'm not sure that forced marriage looks any better than the one that broke up between Austal and Burden.
Well, I do have to say it is a little odd that a year ago, roughly, when the idea of Hanwha buying a chunk of Austal first came up and people said, this could be a little awkward should the Japanese win the contract for the general purpose frigate. Ooh. And at the time, I'm not sure if it was Richard Miles or Dick Miles, but
I think it was Richard because he was very grave and ponderous about the whole thing.
He said, well, you know, the Australian government had no interest in this. It was purely a commercial matter.
Yeah.
Purely a commercial matter. And yet the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, is not a James for some reason, but no, he's a Jim. He looked at this very long and hard and said it was a very complicated matter and it needed to be weighed up very carefully. So evidently it was an issue that the Australian government did have some concerns, a stake in, and had some concerns about. Yeah. Anyway, they've resolved it, and apparently Hanwha can buy a big chunk of Austal. Surprise, surprise, immediately the Japanese came out and said, we have some concerns about this.
You know, I think what the federal government has done with that decision to let Hanwha increase its shareholding, it's now a major shareholder in Austal, is they've just handballed all the problems to the companies. So Richard Miles was absolutely right. They have made it an issue, a commercial set of issues for the companies. But the issues aren't resolved. They've just been handballed to the companies to manage.
Well, the thing I don't quite get around this is, like, getting Hanwha involved. So Hanwha, very experienced, capable shipbuilder.
Company,
You know, the US is going, holy crap, our shipbuilding industry is a train wreck. Let's get the Koreans in and to help sort it out, and we'll draw on their expertise and their skill and their technology. That sounds like a great idea to me, because guess what? Our shipbuilding industry is a bit of a train wreck too.
Yep.
So the idea is let's get some of that hands-on Korean capability in.
Yeah.
However, the terms of this agreement are that will actually, to protect the Japanese intellectual property and their technology, we have to set up a bunch of firewalls so the Koreans can't see it. So essentially what you're saying is the Koreans, well, they can sit on the board, but we're not going to let them actually get involved in shipbuilding.
So we're not getting the benefit that we say we want.
No, you're not really getting the benefit. I'm not seeing what the benefit is at any level that you couldn't get from getting a big cash injection from a venture capital firm.
Or Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. So I think Hanwha Ocean would be a very welcome partner in other places in Australia, right? Like I think about the Sydney, the massive dry dock in Sydney that needs a comprehensive rebuild. I think they'd be a fantastic partner there. But the dumbest place to have them partner is with Austal and Mitsubishi
on
the general purpose frigate.
Where they can't touch the shipbuilding.
Well, yeah, where you have a three-way marriage where one of the partners doesn't get to go into the kitchen. Yeah.
So, all right, other announcement. Well, you'll be very happy to know, Michael, that the government promised that we would start building GMLRS.
Ooh, so the short range.
Long range, 70-kilometre
short range
rockets for the HIMARS launcher. They said we'd start producing them by the end of 2025, which is roughly a week and a bit away. Well, they put out an announcement very recently saying they're going to hit that and production will indeed start by the end of 2025.
Look, I'd love to celebrate that if it was true. They talked about a factory as well, a GMLRS factory in South Australia. Unfortunately, it's not true. Those missiles, GMLRS missiles, Lockheed Martin missiles, are not going to be made in an Australian factory. This is IKEA's business model coming to missiles with Lockheed Martin. Those GMLRS missiles will be assembled in Australia from major components already produced and assembled in America. So to me, I see it as a fantastic example of Lockheed Martin embracing the IKEA business model. And I would love to see the next step from Lockheed Martin down that path, which is to bring the world the GMLRS Lockheed Martin frozen meatball, one of the most popular IKEA products.
Well, I'm not sure they can just rip the idea off. I mean, I think it might be copyrighted, but I like meatballs as much as the next person.
And maybe some Allen keys. Yes. I think some Allen keys as well would be good.
I do have to say, you know, just looking at the government's media release, I'm a little sceptical that, you know, this, at least to start with, is anything resembling mass production. So the announcement, of course, as always,
you keep saying production, by the way, assembly.
they use the term production.
They do, and I think it's a misleading term.
And as always, this is about jobs. There's no discussion in the media release about what actual capability we're going to get out of this.
No.
So it's jobs. But unfortunately, the job numbers are slightly underwhelming. So there's going to be 20 jobs in the production/assembly/meatball facility.
This is where if you were doing the meatballs, you'd have a lot more jobs because you'd be slaughtering the beef, you'd be grinding the beef, you'd be mixing it with eggs. You'd probably have to have a poultry person as well to get the eggs. I reckon Lockheed Martin GMLRS meatballs would bump those job numbers up by about 100 people.
They probably would, but I'm thinking 20 is not going to make a lot of missiles. I'm not an expert here, but I think 20 people are not going to be making a lot of missiles.
I think that's good because I don't think the Australian military has a use for that particular relatively short-range dumb missile. So I think that's an advantage.
You never know until the war starts, Michael. Yeah. But I mean, the fine print does say it will support hundreds more jobs across the supply chain. So slightly vague number.
In America.
Hundreds more jobs.
I noticed that the announcement didn't have a whole lot of Australian component suppliers' names attached to it. Because the last thing I saw from Lockheed Martin about this assembly of US missiles in Australia was that they'd run a pilot program to certify a single Australian company to look at the potential of it perhaps making some of the fins for these rockets in the future.
There was that.
And they weren't in the announcement, that company.
No, there was a previous announcement where we announced many hundreds of millions of dollars to build a big shed. So this is only in a temporary shed. We haven't got the really big shed.
There's a greater shed still.
But there's also hundreds of millions of dollars to potentially certify Australian suppliers.
Yes. Well, that money hasn't been spent yet. So that's got to be spent carefully over the next few years.
Anyway, a little underwhelming. The big question for me is not how many missiles by when. It is, are we crawling, walking or running yet?
No. I think what we're doing is where the baby... And we have just rolled from our back onto our tummy for Lockheed Martin.
Oh, I think we're at least at crawling. So, yes.
We may have
this
given
is
a
the
birth.
Mantra of the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Enterprise is the crawl, walk, run strategy, which we delight in poking a little bit of fun at. I think we're at least crawling now, aren't we?
Well, the Guided Weapons Enterprise is crawling towards its own disestablishment with the greatest reform in defence history. It's being reabsorbed back into the book. So, no, I don't think so. I think we've rolled over onto our tummy and burped lightly.
And it is a bit depressing considering the Houthis and the Ukrainians are running.
Well, they're not crawlers.
No.
Yeah.
All right. What else is going on?
Well, what about the K9?
The K9 self-propelled howitzer, so made by the aforementioned Hanwha company.
Yep.
Looks like the Australian Army has got its hands on the first K9 self-propelled howitzers.
Gee, that's pretty quick. How many years has that taken?
Okay, there's a bit of a wrinkle here. The first wrinkle is it seems like the ones they've got were not actually built here in Australia in the facility that Hanwha set up to build the K9.
Were they assembled at least?
I don't think so.
Are you telling me they were assembled in South Korea?
Yes, yes.
So I thought the whole Geelong factory that Richard Miles had celebrated Dickie Miles had celebrated several times was going to be assembling.
They are assembling them. I just don't think have come off the production line yet. Now, if we
get these things quickly.
No, well, it's not quick because if we cast our minds back not to the last election, not to the one before that, but to the one before that. So the one that's
too young to vote.
The one that Scott Morrison won.
Oh, yeah.
In the lead up to that election, which was May 2019, I believe, Scott Morrison announced that we would be building K9 howitzers
in
Australia.
Yep.
So we're now 6.5 years down the track.
And
from
we
that.
Still will be.
I think it's happening.
Ah.
I just don't think any have yet been complete.
I think they're being crafted like the Bugatti Chiron is made, you know, lovingly handcrafted by Luigi and his wife, have been brought back from retirement because they're the only ones that remember how to do up the particular bolts. So that Bugatti level of craftsmanship is being brought to these canines. And I'm pretty sure Hanwha can't make a lot of these quickly. Can they? Is there another customer anywhere in the world that's got these canines in numbers any faster than the almost 6 years it's taken Australia to get its first couple?
Just on that, there was a recent announcement came out of Poland saying that they had completed delivery of 212 K9 howitzers in the space of about 2 years.
Ah.
They took a slightly different approach from us.
Right. What was their approach?
They bought them directly from the South Koreans, existing South Korean
factory.
But
that's only because the Poles want their military to have military power quickly because they don't have warning time, isn't it?
Well, look, Michael, you and I are both fans of Australian defence industry, but it does come down to that issue of there are some things it makes sense to do here and other things it makes sense to do overseas and to draw on our partners who have existing industrial capability. Yeah. If you're going to build 35 K9 howitzers and roughly, you know, 15-ish ammunition resupply
vehicles
for a total of roughly 50, I'm not sure it makes sense to set up your own factory here.
No, it'd be like setting up the car industry to make 50 vehicles. Yeah.
Now, all right.
I think what we've got to do here is a bit of a takeaways from 2025, Marcus, and outside. Have you finished with military capability?
No, well, interesting segue. Okay, so I think one of the big takeaways of the past year has been the continuing a rapid evolution or revolution of drones, autonomous ooh, systems. So one of the big recent, I think, things we've spoken in the past about in the drone space, you know, if you can imagine it, we're actually seeing
it's probably happened somewhere
in the in Ukraine. Well, one of the things we've just seen is that Ukrainian undersea drones have apparently destroyed a Russian submarine tied up alongside. So,
in fact, the name of the Ukrainian system I thought was a new song that I just hadn't heard, Subsea Baby. So the Subsea Baby has done its work, hasn't it? It got into a protected harbour and it sidled up to the wharf that the Russian submarine was moored at, and it blew up with an enormous explosion.
Yes, and to me, you know, we have both said a number of times, it's not clear to us how our SSNs, by the when we finally get them, how they are going to survive long enough to actually get to sea in a world full of either long-range missile threats or long-range killer drone threats. Yep. And that future is already here. Yep. The other interesting thing which we've read about is that apparently Ukrainian surface drones have been attacking Russian oil tankers in the Mediterranean.
Now, a long way from home.
Way from home. Now, I'm not a huge fan, speaking as a environmentalist, of indiscriminately attacking oil tankers oil on the open around the world. Ocean.
Yep.
But I would refer you to a paper which I wrote with the Chief Technology Officer of C2 Robotics, Tom Lovard, earlier this year, that was published by the Australian Naval Institute, where we had a kind of thought piece saying, what does a world look like in which cheap but long-range lethal undersea drones proliferate?
And now we're seeing theoretically surface drones as well.
Yep. China can make hundreds of thousands of long-range killer drones.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these were surface drones, but whether we're talking subsurface or surface, we are already seeing a world where even sort of mid-size actors can produce these sorts of systems. And if we go back to our recent discussion about the Flower-class Corvette
of World War II,
where you need numbers of vessels. If you want to protect commercial shipping, which apparently is what our Navy is meant to be doing. That's
apparently the whole maritime strategy.
Strategy, you need numbers. Well, the threats are proliferating in terms of numbers.
Well, I'd like to see with AUKUS, you know, I know it's full steam ahead and that's terrific, but where is the strategy and plan to protect these vulnerable, big, expensive items when they're at very predictable places for long periods of time?
Mm-hmm.
Like HMAS Stirling, like the presumably to be built facility at Henderson, like when they start slowly moving out of Osborne in South Australia. Seeing what the Subsea Baby has just done, any reasonable submarine agency would be coming up with a strategy to counter that and telling the Australian population that the $368 billion is not being wasted.
Yeah, well, if the Navy can't protect itself, I'm not sure how it's going to protect hundreds and hundreds of commercial vessels sailing to and from Australia.
Yeah, so there's a takeaway. I think the speed of change and the fact that we're now seeing the small and smart and the many destroy the exquisite, expensive and the few.
Yeah, and to me, the lesson from 2025 in this space is not that somehow we've reached peak autonomous system.
No.
You know, there were arguments that, all of these, you know, FPV, first-person view drones had kind of maxed out their potential in Ukraine because of jamming or, you know, countermeasures.
Both sides had them,
We have certainly not reached peak autonomous system. In fact, if anything, they are accelerating.
Well, the creativity the Ukrainians are showing, and the Houthis demonstrate, by the way, you know, Operation Spiderweb, that incredible use of shorter-range drones delivered by unwitting Russian truck drivers to destroy Russian strategic bombers thousands of kilometres away from Ukraine.
And while those developments are accelerating the delivery of traditional systems, whether it's canine self-propelled howitzers or Hunter-class frigates, just seems to be slowing.
Yeah. Now, sort of thinking about the political and strategic takeaways of 2025, I've got a few. And my first one would be the February meeting between Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky and US President Donald J. Trump, that infamous meeting in the White House where J.D. Vance was part of yelling at Zelensky, saying he never said thank you, he wasn't respectful enough, grateful enough, and Donald Trump, using that line he's used several times since, "You don't have the cards," sounding like a mafia boss who's just about to have somebody iced.
I think we did an episode where we compared it literally to a mafia don shaking down some poor shopkeeper. Yep.
But the reason it's a takeaway for me is it actually set the direction of US policy on Ukraine and Russia, which is Ukraine's the problem, not Russia. In fact, Russia is the land of opportunity for re-energized American business deals around oil and gas. And we've seen that made much more explicit in the national security strategy that came out of the Trump administration. So that February meeting actually set a whole direction, as did J.D. Vance's address to the Munich Security Conference, where he told Europe there are a bunch of declining wasters. And that now has been
enshrined in the national security strategy.
So to me, those two things, but the Munich speech and the February meeting.
Yep. Well, a related takeaway for me from that is the Europeans have actually seen this, the writing on the wall, or the writing in the national security strategy, or the actual words out of senior Trump officials. And they are trying to do something about it. They have recognized that they cannot rely on the US. Now, that's a good thing. It's something that should have happened a long time ago, but they have realized they cannot rely on the US. Some have gone even further. You know, the Danes, their security services are actually describing the US as a threat.
Well, given the current US government wants to take part of their territory in the form of Greenland, that is just a dose of reality for them to see the US as a threat to their territorial integrity.
Yes. Yeah. Now, how effective the Europeans are being, you know, that's, we can discuss that. You know, are they willing to actually step up and spend the amount of money they need to kind of replace the void created by the withdrawal of the Americans?
In the time frame. And I'd say they're fumbling around financing Ukraine with its continued war economy.
they're held up by the Belgians. We're going, this may come back to bite us. Yeah. The fact that we're part of NATO and the US, they're worried, won't protect them.
Well,
I mean,
they're worried about
show some spine, God's sake.
They're worried about future Russian litigation, but there's a bigger problem with the Russians, which is Russian military aggression. So I think that, yeah, for me, the jury's out on whether Europe can stop tangling itself up in knots and act with speed. But at least there's problem recognition there. And I would say a big takeaway for me, which was entirely unexpected in 2024, was having a German chancellor say repeatedly the transatlantic partnership is broken and over and Europe needs to stand up for itself. And embarking on a rearmament of Germany that is welcomed by Europe and hated by Russia.
Interestingly, that seems to be very different from what is going on closer to home here in Australia. I mean, yes, we can argue about how effective the Europeans will be, but at least they're having the conversation.
Well, at least
our government is not having the conversation at all. We're still in denial. I mean, we have these weird, like Osman recently, this sort of, we're going through the formula of it.
Of turning up at Osman and saying, this is a peak meeting for the alliance, it's never been stronger. And we've got all these boilerplate lines about the strength of the alliance and how we're doing more together more than ever before.
Full steam ahead.
But to me, there was an air of obvious artificiality and superficiality to that whole Osman engagement. And that's because at some level that the government and our security establishment cannot even admit to itself, let alone the Australian public. They know there have been cataclysmic changes to America and to America's approach to its allies. And they cannot speak about it because if they speak about it, they have to think about it and they have to do something about it. So that's why we just got the repetition that we talked about in the last podcast of full steam ahead. The only words able to be used about AUKUS and Osman were superficial repeated quotes from Donald Trump.
So that is very depressing. Now, there are no easy solutions here, but if you're not even willing to have, you know, discussion about the problem, you're not going to reach any kind of solution. So the only solution we seem to be kind of hoping for at the moment is that in 3 years' time, Donald Trump goes away and everything goes back to the way it was before. Well, it is not going back to the way it was before. America has changed, but also that great power relationship between the US and China has changed and is continuing to change. Mm-hmm. The power balance has fundamentally shifted. So we're not going back.
Well, also, I'm not sure the American government sees it as the kind of power competition that previous American governments did. Because another big takeout for me, again, it's in their national security strategy, but even more than that, it's in the actions of the Trump administration towards China. There's been a massive move away from seeing it as strategic technological competition that America might not be winning, towards, well, actually, our big problem is we're not getting enough economic benefit out of China. So we need to make sure we're getting a bit more of the action. So think about the NVIDIA chip directions and decisions by America. So Biden bans NVIDIA selling its advanced AI chips to China because they're in the middle of a technological and scientific competition with AI in the middle of it. Trump continues the ban and then says, actually, no, you can get these advanced chips, China, but you just have to give me a piece of the action.
I want
25% of NVIDIA's revenue. So this whole approach is big new news for anyone thinking you're in a collective strategic partnership with America.
Yeah. I mean, I think the overarching kind of wrap-up of this is the rules-based global order is dead. Okay, we have moved beyond that, and now we are in an era, I think, of, you know, what the political scientists would describe, you know, a state of anarchy. You know, realists would say
it's always
a state of anarchy. We've just sort of managed to paper it over a bit, but you know, the blinkers have been torn away now, and we're seeing the international order or disorder for what it truly is. I'm not sure about that, but what I will say is we are entering a state, I think, of anarchy. Anarchy in the sense of, you know, power being exerted by the powerful in their own interests, and that there are no rules. The only rules are ones that are set up by the powerful to serve their own interests.
Yeah, well, you could say the U.S. actions against Venezuela and the U.S. Killings of people that they say tell us drug smugglers are an example of that. That's just the powerful doing what they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, releasing the video of U.S. Special Forces capturing a Venezuelan oil tanker and proudly telling us that's unclassified, but not releasing the video of the U.S. military killing two people on a little bit of debris from a boat that was blown up by the Americans because that's top secret. I think that is that power-based world that we've talked about.
But another depressing aspect of this, I don't know, maybe it's actually a positive aspect, I'm not sure, but the Trump administration isn't even good at the shameless exercise of power, because in this new world where they're basically going, well, the powerful will have their spheres of influence. And the one rule is that the powerful have their sphere of influence and will recognize other powerful countries' spheres of influence in which they can do whatever they want. So Russia, yeah, if you want Ukraine, fine, you know, you can have it. We get Latin America. We get the Western Hemisphere.
Yes.
Well, what a step back that is from where we were only, you know, a few years ago with the US essentially wanting to kind of set the rules for the rules-based global order. Now they're saying, well, China, you can have Eurasia, we'll have Latin America. You know, as much as I like, you know, Latin American culture and music and food and dance as much as the next person, if you want to have a choice of controlling Eurasia versus controlling Latin America, I mean,
if you play Monopoly,
set your sights pretty low.
If you play Monopoly, you do want to get hold of some sets where you can build hotels cheaply and quickly. But the path to dominance in Monopoly is not staying in the cheap seats. You've got to go where the money and prosperity is. And to give up Eurasia in exchange for the Western Hemisphere when you already own the United States of America seems to be an own goal. And this was another of my takeaways from 2025. America has been engaged in extensive, repeated, deliberate with unwitting consequences, self-harm.
Mm-hmm.
America has been engaging in a year of self-harm this year and seems set on a course for three more years of self-harm. And while it's committing self-harm, it's also harming its allies, partners, and friends. And that to me is a big takeaway. And it leads to my last one, which is I had fears that there might be a G2 instead of the rules-based global order and instead of anarchy, that we might have a G2 agreed between Washington and Beijing and they would make decisions for the rest of us. I'm not worried about that now, but that's not for a good reason.
Why are you not worried about it, Michael?
Because I think the Chinese Communist Party and Xi Jinping have looked at the Trump administration and President Donald J. Trump himself and said, we can't make deals that mean anything with this bunch and that guy. They're just inherently unreliable. So any deal we make, we can't have confidence they'll deliver. And even bigger than that, they're making the calculation, when your adversary is making a mistake, don't interrupt them. So they're just watching this enormous self-harm that America's inflicting on itself.
Well, if you think you're winning a competition, why would you sort of start negotiating with the person you're beating? It's like
if you win,
we're winning on science and technology. We're winning on economics. We're probably going to win on Taiwan. You know, so why would you want to get into negotiations that could limit how much you're winning?
That's right. It's all downside for Beijing to enter into an arrangement with America right now. And that, to me, is the biggest and worst takeout of 2025.
Ah, good times, Michael. Well, sorry to our listeners to end on that very depressing note.
Well, there is a positive, of course, and that is that the new Mar-a-Lago-themed Trumpy strategist bunker is fully operational, and it does lighten your mood. In fact, the statue of Donald J. Trump, I think the one you selected, is a bit Buddha-like, and so there's a message of peace and unity there.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, if people want to make a small or large donation to Strategic Analysis Australia, we could actually invite them into the bunker to enjoy the ambiance.
That's true.
And so make us an offer.
Well, yeah, make us an offer, but you're just after more party pies. Marcus, let's start the next year with a look forward and what we think about the year. But, yeah, that's 2025.
Hopefully something a little more optimistic.
Yep. All right, Merry Christmas.